20th? April 20th, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
April 20th, 2012. Matchless Gifts in London.
There might be some new people. I don't
know. There might, you know. Hi, Krishna. I hope you can all hear me. Everybody hear me? Okay, if you can't hear me, just let me know and I'll try to talk a little louder. So we've come to talk tonight about the role of women in the science of bhakti yoga or Krishna consciousness. So are most of you already familiar with Krishna consciousness? Is there anyone here who doesn't know anything at all about bhakti yoga and Krishna consciousness? Anyone who knows just like nothing? Is your first time here and you're just kind of checking it out? Okay, a couple people. So is it all right if we give just a little brief overview of what bhakti is first then? Just very briefly? Okay, and then we'll get into the role of women in bhakti. So what bhakti yoga is a way of reaching not only enlightenment, but ultimate enlightenment. Finding who we really are, what is our actual place in reality, by getting back to the source of all of our problems and eliminating them at the source. Defeating illusion and coming back to reality. So our original situation as an eternal spiritual being is to be in knowledge of ourself, to be in knowledge of our source, the absolute truth, one of whose many names is Krishna, which means all attractive, to be aware of our source, Krishna, and to have a relationship of love with our source, and therefore with everything else, with all other life. Oh, okay. And to see ultimately everything, that's fine. Just didn't know what it was. To see ultimately everything as spiritual. And in that consciousness, there's no question of misery or suffering. One attains to transcendental consciousness. We see who I am, who is my source, Krishna, what is my relationship of love with my source, with the ultimate truth, and what is my relationship of love with everyone and everything else. Then one gets clear knowledge, clear vision. One can decide what to do, what not to do, what is fearful, what is not fearful, how to behave. And then one achieves perfection and success in life. All other attempts at success in life are under the spell of illusion. So any other attempt to be successful in life that's not understanding who I really am and where I really come from and what is the reality of creation has to result in something that's less than satisfactory. Exactly like if you want to go someplace in London, you need to have
a guide
or a map or a sat nav or something. Right? An A to Z. I mean, you could just kind of wander the streets and you might see some interesting things. But if you want to get something in particular, that will be very difficult. So if we want to get success, if we want to get unlimited happiness, if we want to get full knowledge, if we want to have a life full of vitality forever, if we want to have relationships with others that are free from exploitation and misunderstanding and anguish, if we want to have real success, then we have to see things clearly. If we're in a fog, then we can't find our destination. So bhakti allows us to see things as they are. It allows us to see things in truth by connecting with the truth of who I am and my relationship with Krishna. So that's the essence of bhakti as a theoretical construct. As a practical construct, what do you do to achieve this? I mean, it sounds very nice, but if you're just going to say, all right, I'm just going to sit down and find out the truth of who I am and connect with Krishna, you know, how do you do that? It becomes very vague. So those who have already done that, called sadhus, a sadhu is one who's in sat, or eternal truth, reality, goodness. So those who are sadhus or sattvikas, they give us the path, which is to hear about Krishna, to hear about the truth, to talk about the truth, to remember the truth, to serve the truth, to worship the truth, to make friends with the truth, and to give everything to the truth. To serve those things that are related to the truth. The truth, ultimate truth, again, who has many names, and one of the most wonderful names is Krishna, the all-attractive. And there's a process for doing that. There's a process for hearing about truth and for remembering truth and for speaking about truth. And this process has been systematized and analyzed and explained in a wonderful way by persons such as Rupa Goswami in his book Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which we have translated by the founder of our movement in the West, Srila Prabhupada. So that is the system for attaining bhakti. Then, well, what kind of practical result do you get if you follow the system of bhakti? We should also say, not only being absorbed in hearing and talking about and remembering and serving and worshipping and loving and being friends with and giving everything to the truth, to Krishna, but also avoiding those things which are so filled with falsity that truth becomes impossible. So one of those things is the killing of animals, the eating of meat, fish, and eggs. That puts us in a position of heavy illusion and falsity. Because the idea of eating meat, fish, and eggs is that in order to live, I have to take the life of an innocent, sentient being. So that's just simply not true. And it breeds a mood instead of love and service. It breeds a mood of exploitation and harm to others, which is the opposite of Krishna. Then no illicit sex. So illicit sex is also exploitive. Sex in marriage means that I dedicate myself to you, you dedicate yourself to me. We're sticking here for each other, not just I use you for a day or an hour and then I go away. And even within marriage, it should be non-exploitive. There can be exploitive sex even within marriage. So we work with the harmony of the, we're in harmony with the way that our bodies are created. Even in marriage, sex should be pro-creation. It should be in favor of creation. How our bodies are constructed, how the world is constructed, and how our bodies are constructed is that sex is naturally connected with children, which is a bond of love between the husband, the wife, and the child. And anything else is more or less exploitive and false. So other kinds of sex means you have to distort the functions of the body in some false way, or you distort your relationship with the other person in some way. Then no intoxication. So intoxication gives us an illusion within an illusion. Already we're illusioned and thinking that I'm a material being, that I belong to this world, that success is getting money and prestige and nice clothes and a beautiful place to live in this world, none of which is our real success. That's trying to get success without a map. So we're already intoxicated in one sense by this idea that I am a material being, part of this world. And other kinds of intoxication, alcohol, marijuana, whatever, it simply adds, bless you, it simply adds a layer of illusion. In fact, the main reason people take intoxication is they become aware that, you know, I'm really not happy in materialistic consciousness. And instead of trying to find a way out of that materialistic consciousness and come to the truth, they simply deaden their sense of dissatisfaction with the illusion. So intoxication removes the natural urge in human life for enlightenment. It says, you know, and there's other, besides chemical intoxicants, our whole modern society is a kind of intoxication. You know, all of our, a lot of our stores and our entertainment is all just, don't look for enlightenment. This is, yes, you will find enlightenment chemically or electronically, but mostly it's don't look for enlightenment. Just try to be happy in the world. So we have a generally intoxicating culture. And no, gambling. Gambling is also false. Gambling is, I'm going to try to make money without an honest exchange of goods and services. So we all have a right and a duty to maintain ourselves, but it should be in an honest way. So if we take money from somebody, we should be giving something in return. And when you're gambling, you're taking money from other people without giving them anything in return, except the hope that they can take money from you without giving anything in return. So, you know, everyone buys their lottery tickets and they hope that they collect a little bit of money from each of their neighbors without giving their neighbors anything. So, of course, gambling is a very interesting kind of cheating because everybody agrees to be cheated with the hope that they'll get to cheat others. So it's considered to be, gambling is considered to be the chief form of cheating. You know, if you just con somebody out of their money, but people are agreeing, they're knowing that you're more likely to be hit by lightning than to win the lottery, and still they buy their tickets. So things that are seeped in falsity, one has to give up. So what are the practical results of engaging in bhakti? The practical result is that one starts to clear the fog, the dust, like if you had a very dirty room. You know, if you move into some place that hasn't been cleaned for a long time and you start cleaning, or you get some item that's really tarnished. If you've ever gotten at some metal item that's really tarnished and you're cleaning it, or a pot that has something burned on it. I remember one time I was heating up some milk and a friend of mine had a crisis and I went to help her and I forgot that I had milk on the stove. And when I came back, my whole flat was full of smoke, and it took me 1 month before I could got that pot cleaned. You know, I would work on it maybe a half an hour a day. So when you do bhakti, it's kind of like scrubbing the inner surface of the heart. And after a while of scrubbing that pot, I started to see a little bit of the metal underneath the charred substance. That was an exciting day. You know, and when you see a little bit, right, at first all you see is black. All you see is the burnt on substance, and as you're, so bhakti also is like that. When you start bhakti, at first what you'll see is, wow, I'm really an illusion. I've been living my life in falsity. It's like all of a sudden you start looking at this burnt bottom of the pot, but as you go on in bhakti, as you go on absorbing yourself in the truth, then gradually after some time you'll see, oh, there's a little bit of the real me. How wonderful I am as a spiritual soul. I'm bright and shiny. You know, I'm godly. I'm a divine, spiritual, eternal being who has most of the qualities of God himself. One can have up to 78% of the qualities of God. And one starts to see oneself, and eventually all of the false illusory things are taken away. Then another aspect of understanding bhakti is, how did we get this particular life and this particular body? So we have this particular life and this particular body because of our various flavors of illusory activities that we've done in other lifetimes. So with all different flavors of illusion you can have. You can have the male illusion, the female illusion, the black illusion, the Indian illusion, the Chinese illusion, the British illusion, the German illusion, the American illusion. It's like a big ice cream store with thousands of flavors. And they're all ice cream, but, you know, one of them's pistachio ice cream, one of them's strawberry ice cream. Oh, I didn't taste that one yet. Let me taste that one. So we try in one life after another. Let me try this false identity. Let me try this false identity. And we get our particular identities from one life to the other, depending on what we want and what we do, because what we want and what we do are very connected. I think all of us tend to say, I want this and I want that, but we don't actually do anything to get those things, right? Don't we all have things like that in our life? I think everybody has some things like that. You know, we say, I like this, but I'm not going to take the trouble to do it. Like, I visit India a lot. I'd love to learn Hindi, but only if I could, you know, put something under my pillow and learn while I was sleeping. And I can actually take the trouble to do it. So we get our bodies not just by what we want in a theoretical way, but what we want badly enough to act on. And that's called karma. Karma literally means action. what actions I take based on my desires, and then I get another body, one life after another, based on my desires. Bhakti cleanses the heart of all of these illusory desires and awakens our actual spiritual desires so that we no longer get another material body because we don't want one. There are many people who say we get what we want, and that's true. Although that's what we want by what we do, not what we want just by what I want, but what we want as translated into action. So then we revive our original spiritual form. We no longer have to reincarnate on this planet or on any other planet or in any other universe. And we can regain our eternal relationship with Krishna, who is our source and ultimate truth. So I think I've covered all the main topics of what is bhakti. Did I leave out anything crucial? I think it was pretty complete. Okay. 15-minute summary of what is bhakti. Bhakti literally means bhakti yoga. Yoga means to link. Bhakti means with love and devotion. Real love and devotion, something that's not mixed with any selfishness or with some desire for anything but to please the beloved. And in this science of bhakti, anyone can take part. So we're talking particularly... Can you all still hear me? Am I doing okay with volume? So we're looking particularly at women in the practice of bhakti. So as a system of spirituality, and as... I hate to call it a religion. I really wouldn't say that bhakti yoga is a religion in the way that we understand religion. Religion generally means how to be a good person within the illusion. That's generally what's understood by religion. How can you follow principles of morals and ethics? And how can you be afraid of, obedient out of fear to a supreme lord, and in that way lead a good life and get nice things and get nice illusory things? That's generally what people mean by religion. Although the ultimate meaning of religion... The ultimate meaning of religion, which can be translated as dharma, is what is the essential principle of life, which is giving of oneself happily in loving service. So in that sense, bhakti yoga is a religion. You could say it's the ultimate or essential feature of religion. Just like Jesus said, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. That's the essence of religion. But most Christians don't really focus on that. Or they focus on, you know, I love God better than you love God kind of thing. So they sort of lose the... Not all of them, of course, there are some genuine Christians, but they often lose the point. So in this bhakti yoga, or linking with our source, with Krishna, in love and devotion, this is open to anyone who's alive. There's not even a restriction that you have to be human, although it's very difficult to practice bhakti yoga and gain enlightenment if you're not human. But there are examples in our scriptures and our sacred literatures of even non-humans becoming enlightened through bhakti. We have the example of Hanuman, who's a monkey, not an ordinary monkey. He belongs to a race of kind of half-human, half-monkeys. They're called... Kim Purushas, which means, is that a person? That's what Kim Purusha means. Is that a person? That's the literal, literal meaning of the Sanskrit term Kim Purusha. What? Person? Huh? So in our scriptures it describes that for millions of years there have existed entities, and they still exist somewhere, that are partially monkey, partially human. They're not some chain in evolution. They've always existed as a distinct species. And sometimes, even today, people see such beings and report them, although there doesn't seem to be many of them, and they seem to be rather elusive. But Hanuman, it was one of these. He was basically like a monkey, but he was a monkey who had language, who could walk upright and who had language. So he was an enlightened being. He was pure in the consciousness of Krishna. Also, there was a bird, Jatayu, who also attained enlightenment. Bears, there's several instances in the incarnation of Krishna called Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there was a dog who attained enlightenment. So that's certainly unusual, but it's possible. Anyone who's alive can engage in the science of bhakti. But generally, to engage in bhakti, one has to be in the human form. Because below the human form, an animal cannot, most animals don't have some system of spirituality. They're just concerned with getting food, finding a safe place to sleep, finding a mate, defending themselves. And of course, if human beings are only doing those things, if a human being is only worried about food and sleeping and sex and defense, no matter how gorgeously, in whatever fancy way, if they're not interested in enlightenment and spirituality, then they're really not any better than, you know, animals with clothes on. If the art and the science and the technology of human beings is only engaged with eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, then it's just like you see sometimes these dogs where their owners put on sweaters and booties and get them fancy haircuts at the dog hair salon. So that certainly isn't much different. But bhakti is generally for anybody who's a human being, who's inquiring, what am I doing here? Who am I? Why am I suffering? Is there a truth? What is the truth? Is there God? What is he like? What do I do? What's the purpose of life? What is success? How do I find it? What's going on here? You ever wonder that? What's going on here? Who's ever said, something's funny about this world? Something's really funny. Have you ever been in a dream where you were eating and you wondered why you weren't satisfied? You ever had that happen in a dream? Or drinking water? I've had a dream where I was very thirsty when I went to bed. And in my dream, I was drinking, you know, jugs of water. And at a certain point in my dream, I thought, why am I still thirsty? And then I woke up and realized, oh, I was dreaming. So in a life of illusion, that also happens. You do everything everybody told you to do. You go to school, you get the good grades, you bring home your report card to your parents, and they say, yes, great grades, okay, I did that thing, tick. You know, then you get the good job for the reputable company. You get a nice salary and some status, a job where you can proudly say to your friends, this is what I do for a living. And your parents can say to their friends, my son is a this. So you do that, tick, and then you get the perfect partner, someone who's attractive, someone you just click with, oh, like your soulmate, and it's just wonderful and perfect, tick, and then you get a nice place to live, you decorate it the way you want in the perfect part of town, and you have the right furniture and the right books and everything, everyone. Oh, and the right gadgets. You've got to have the right gadgets. And you always make sure you get the latest one. As soon as the latest one comes out, never mind that the thing you have now works just fine. You go and get the latest thing. So when all your friends come over, you say, I have the latest thing. And then you can watch television just like you're in an IMAX 3D theater right in your living room. Tick that one off, right? Oh, and then you've got to have kids, or maybe nobody wants kids anymore, I don't know, but then you've got to have kids, and they've got to be real, they've got to be beautiful, and they've got to be intelligent, and they go to the best schools, and they get the best child, and you do all that. Tick. And then you do something good for society. Maybe you give in charity, or you volunteer your time, or you help out people who are needy. You really try to be a good person and contribute in some meaningful way to society. Tick. And then sometimes you look and say, why aren't I satisfied? Is that all? Now, if you haven't ticked off all those boxes, you may be thinking, if I just tick off the ones I haven't ticked off, then I'll be satisfied. But every time you tick one off, you think, why aren't I happy? What's wrong with me? Everyone else who ticks off this box, they're happy. Something must be wrong with me. Maybe I got the wrong degree, or the wrong job, or the wrong partner, or something. Or the wrong gadget. I bought it from the wrong company. You know? I should have gotten that kind of computer. I should have gotten that partner. Okay, let me get a different partner. Let me get a different computer. Let me get a different car. Let me live in a different country. And every once in a while we say, why isn't it working? Why aren't I finding the satisfaction that I wanted? And if you really become fully human, you stop saying, what's wrong with me? What's the other box I have to tick off? Maybe I ticked the wrong box. And you start saying, what's wrong with this place? There's something funny going on here. And if you have honest friends, they'll tell you they're not happy either. Now, generally, we don't have honest friends. Generally, our friends say, oh, yes, I'm so happy. My son just got into the best school, and I just got this, and I am happy. Right? But if you really have honest friends, they'll tell you, I've ticked off the boxes, and it didn't do it for me either. I'm still wondering what's wrong. So it's that person, really, that's qualified to take up bhakti. The person who says, what's going on here? What's the problem? Exactly like in a dream, where you say, why am I doing all these things and I'm still not happy? And then you wake up and you say, oh, it was a dream. It wasn't really happening to me. I wasn't really eating the food or drinking the water or going to that wonderful place. So a real human being wakes up and says, none of these things I'm doing in this world are happening to me. I'm just a witness. They're not touching me, the self. So anybody who asks that question is qualified to take up bhakti. And it doesn't matter whether you're male or female. It doesn't matter whether you're in the Mensa society or you can hardly write your name. It doesn't matter whether you're full of health or you can hardly get out of bed in the morning. It doesn't matter whether you're a highly accomplished person or, you know, if you brush your teeth, that's a good day. It just doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter how efficient you are. It doesn't matter how organized you are. It doesn't matter what gender you are. It doesn't matter what nationality you are. It doesn't matter how smart, how healthy, how fat you are, how skinny you are. None of those things matter at all. None of those are qualifications. It certainly doesn't matter if you're male or female. What it matters is that you say, what's going on here? Who am I? Why aren't I really satisfied? I want the truth. I'm tired of illusion. I want to find that thing which really satisfies me. So that's the qualification for taking up bhakti. And there really isn't that much difference between how men and women take up bhakti. The only real difference at all in the way men and women take up bhakti is that in addition to the basic activities of bhakti, hearing about the truth, talking about the truth, remembering the truth, serving the truth, becoming a good friend of the truth, giving everything to the truth, worshiping the truth, that we also still have some activities to do to maintain this body, even though this body is a product of our illusory and false desires. We still have to brush our teeth and comb our hair and wash our clothes. Although people very, very advanced in bhakti, like great yogis, sometimes there are some examples of great bhakti yogis who are able to dispense with practically everything on the material plane. But that can't be imitated, and that's unusual even for an enlightened being to live like that. So for most of us, there's still things to do in relationship to this body and this mind that we have. And because each of us have a different kind of body and mind, those activities are going to be slightly different or sometimes greatly different from one person to another. And we can talk about broad categories of the kind of work that we do in this world. Some people like to do things that are engaged with the arts and entertainment and with crafts and with skills. Some people like to generate wealth in society, to use the natural resources of the world, the water and the soil and the animals, to produce prosperity and food. Some people like to take care of others, to manage others, like we see with people who run governments. Other people like to protect and nurture truth and philosophy. So according to what one finds one's life in, someone was asking me today, you know, what should I do? I said, what gives you life? What gives you energy? What's the kind of thing where when you're doing it, you can forget about eating and you know, oh, I have to eat lunch. Oh, I don't want to stop what I'm doing. Oh, I got to go to sleep now. So each of us has something that suits our particular body and mind. And we should also use that in the service of truth. So obviously there's some differences in general between a man and a woman in terms of what sort of services that we are going to do on the bodily platform and therefore what we offer to Krishna. And other than that, there really isn't a whole lot of difference. And those things that are differences are not very important. So if one person likes to study philosophy in the service of the truth and the other person likes to make beautiful paintings in the service of the truth, it doesn't matter. One is not higher than the other or better than the other on the absolute platform, although one may be higher or better than the other from a materialistic point of view. So part of what has to be done in bhakti, because we're trying to access the truth, is also be aware of the authentic nature of the particular body and mind that we have in this life. In illusion, one is always thinking, if I just had a little different situation, I would be happy. If I just had a little bit better, you know, computer, or a little bit better spouse, or a little bit better nose, or a little bit better something. And we think this way also about our personality and our body. You know, if I could only be a little bit more organized, or if I could just be a little bit more quiet, or a little bit more outgoing, or a little bit more friendly, or a little bit more something, that then I would be happy. But those are actually desires and illusion. There's no difference between thinking, if only I had a better house, I'd be happy, and if only I was more quiet, I'd be happy. Those are both illusory things. So part of advancing in bhakti is understanding whatever body and mind I have, I have. I have it because of my past karma and my past material desires, so it's basically a bad bargain. But as our founder and my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, said, you make the best use of a bad bargain. Whatever body and mind we have this life, that's what we have. One can get plastic surgery or, you know, go through all sorts of psychological shenanigans to try to change who we are, but it's who we are. It's just what we have in this life. It's not who I am eternally. Trying to pretend you're someone else is something like getting plastic surgery. Remember seeing this one woman who, she didn't look younger, she just looked stretched, you know. So weird. You're thinking, oh, it's like she's a mask on, you know. Or just like when people dye their hair, it never looks real and you always see the roots, isn't it? So trying to artificially imitate somebody that we're not is a waste of time and it's a waste of energy. So to understand, okay, what kind of body do I have? What kind of mentality do I have? What's the natural inclination of my body and my mentality? And that, of course, changes also not only in one life, but over the lifespan, our natural inclinations can also change. You know, generally, when we're in youth, we want to do things and be very active. And as you get older, people often become more contemplative and more retired from activities. So this is when we're young, we want to study everything. So these sort of things, there's a natural progression. So we understand, this is the kind of body I have. This is the kind of mind I have. I'm not going to try to fix it and make it perfect because I'll never be able to do that. If I try to get the perfect personality in this life and the perfect body in this life, all it'll do is those desires will propel me to another lifetime. So instead of doing that, whatever kind of body I have, whatever kind of personality I have, use that in the understand it truthfully and use that in the service of truth. And part of being a woman in Krishna consciousness is to understand what are the natural inclinations of the body of a woman. And instead of trying to act like something else, to do that for Krishna. So that's pretty simple in a nutshell. What does it mean to be a woman in Krishna consciousness? And we have examples in our scriptures of many great saintly persons who were women. In fact, I have somebody counting it for me, so I don't have the number yet, but there's a certain percentage of the verses in our scripture that were spoken by women. We have, in fact, big sections of our main scripture, Srimad Bhagavatam, that were spoken by various women. Srila Prabhupada particularly liked the prayers of Queen Kunti, which he spoke on at length and we published as a separate book. But there's also many sections by the village girls of Vrindavan. There's whole chapters in the Bhagavatam of the philosophical understanding and the deep longings of transcendental love expressed by these village girls, who from a material point of view, they weren't scholars, but they were the most saintly persons. And other saintly ladies like Draupadi, Devahuti, Devaki, etc. And of course, in our modern age, we have Ganga Goswamini, Janava Mata, Himalata Thakurani, and even at the present time, there are many very saintly women in the science of bhakti. So I've ended early. Why don't we, if you're interested, we can have an open question answer time. If we all run out of questions before it's time for the feast, then we can have more kirtan. But any questions at all? It could be on anything I talked about or anything that you like.
Maybe Mother Irma, if you could talk a little bit about relationship between men and women within Krishna consciousness.
The relationship between men and women. All right. Well, one of the items of illusion is thinking that the main way I'm going to be happy is through romantic relationships that are separate from Krishna. It's one of the main items of illusion. Basically, illusion is I'm going to be happy separate from the truth. And this relationship between men and women, it's a really high, really intense level of, or can be, a very intense level of illusion. I am enjoying the world. I am the enjoyer. It binds us to materialistic life. If you think about most of the things people do, most of the materialistic things people do, it's very related with impressing the opposite sex, getting the opposite sex, keeping your relationship with the opposite sex. So this particular relationship is very tricky. How to have a relationship between men and women in such a way that it helps both of them towards enlightenment. Not easy. Not easy at all. It's actually the relationship that is most likely to pull us away from enlightenment. Therefore, you find in every spiritual system that there are people who take vows of celibacy. And they live away from the general mass of people and they're not involved in sexual things at all. Of course, in the yoga tradition, they don't repress sexuality. But they physiologically take the biological sexual energy up to the brain. In other words, they use their sexual energy for study and for meditation rather than for entanglement in the world. But if men and women are going to have a spiritual relationship that will help them in the truth, they have to see each other as spiritual beings and not as the body. If you see that a woman is a woman, then a man will think, how can I enjoy this woman? And if a woman sees a soul in a man's body as a man, she thinks, how can I enjoy this man? So we have to see each other as spiritual beings and treat each other with respect and not exploitation. That's the essence of it. The general tendency between men and women is to exploit each other. It's a general tendency. And a man exploits a woman in a different way than a woman exploits a man. But the principle is there, that's the tendency. You know, even in marriage, there's books on married life that'll tell you, you know, how women keep score and how men keep score. That means it's essentially a business deal instead of love. It's very hard to find real love Actually, if you're in material consciousness, you're not capable of giving real love. You just can't do it. The only time you can give real love is when you're in transcendental consciousness. So it's possible to have relationships between men and women that help each other spiritually. But it's definitely a challenge. Any other questions? Yes.
Sometimes from, say, reading Srimad Bhagavatam, perhaps from Bhagavad Gita, maybe I'm thinking of Srimad Bhagavatam, there are some descriptions about women that seem to be, perhaps, I don't know if negative is the word, but quite difficult to read when you're a woman. And there's been, perhaps in the times of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, where some of the saints did not even want to be touched by the shadow of a woman and things like that. So
I don't remember reading that. But, all right, because what is the essence of our illusion? The essence of our illusion is that we want to enjoy separately from the truth. I want to be the center. The truth is, I'm not the center. Mm-hmm. Just like the problem with ecology on this planet is human beings thinking we're the only ones that matter. The animals don't matter, the insects don't matter, the earth doesn't matter, it's only human beings that matter, and we only matter for this generation, isn't it? That we are the center. I saw a really nice graphic of, you know, human being in the center and all of nature is around the human being, and then another graphic where human being was part of nature. I don't know if you've seen that. It's very, very well done. So as soon as I think I'm the center and I'm meant to enjoy everything, then I cause chaos. But all of us who are in conditioned life are thinking that we are the center, that we are the enjoyer. So what do we want to enjoy? So Krishna has his energy of enjoyment, his pleasure energy. It's called Ladini Shakti. And this energy of enjoyment is female. So people talk about, is God male or female? He's both. Radha and Krishna. Krishna as the potent and Radha as the potency. So the energy that produces the unlimited bliss of the Absolute Truth is feminine energy. But that feminine energy only produces unlimited bliss when used with the energetic. Like the sunshine has to be connected with the sun. So illusion means that I want to take the energy away from the energetic. I want to take the potency away from the potent and use it myself. So one may want to do that by taking a male form and having one's own little female representative of the pleasure potency as one's wife or girlfriend. And or one may want to be that potency oneself. One may want to get a body oneself like that potency. So that's a deeper level of illusory desires. How do I want to try to enjoy the pleasure potency separately from Krishna? As my wife or girlfriend, or as my own body? So those of us who've taken female form, it's like we want to be the energy of illusion. We don't want to possess it in the form of another person. We want to possess it in our own body. And if you think about even in modern egalitarian society, if you want to symbolize material life, how do you do it? You use a young, attractive woman, isn't it? Why is it that the men's magazines are full of pictures of women and the women's magazines are full of pictures of women? So the men are lusting after the women and the women are envying the women. The men are thinking, if only I could have a woman with a body like that in my house. And the woman is thinking, if only I could have that as my body. Right? So the female form symbolizes the desire to be an illusion. And those of us who have female forms, it's because of many reasons, but essentially you could say that our desire to be an illusion is greater. Some of us have female forms because we weren't very nice to women in our last lives. Or some because we were much too attached to a woman. But many reasons. So I think that in most of the cultures of the world, it's understood that the female form is dangerous. That female sexuality is dangerous. Most societies try a lot more to regulate and control female forms and female sexuality than they try to control male sexuality. So you just see it like that. It's not really against, the... saying be careful of this urge to want to be an illusion. So if you're a woman, you have to, how am I going to use my body? How am I going to use the subtle forms of attractiveness and sexuality? Yes, sir.
Some questions. What is, from their own perspective, the purpose of living?
Happiness. We want to live so we can enjoy eternal, unlimited happiness. Yes, sir.
I'm just a little bit confused, really, because you talk about spiritual love and there's this sexual relationship, and it's almost as if I just don't really understand that there is a material component to it. It seems to be inescapable, really.
Material component too. There definitely is.
In a way, I feel like you're putting it down a bit, but it shouldn't, if it's wrong.
I'm putting it down a lot.
You're talking about truth.
Yes.
That is the truth
of it's the truth reflected in a funhouse mirror.
But you don't see that illusion as part of a living person.
That illusion is part of something that's ultimately real, yes. The happiness, the connection, the love, the satisfaction, the creative potency that we seek through sexuality exists in reality, in spiritual truth.
Why try to cover it up?
Oh, no, we're trying to uncover it.
No, I mean physically cover it. You're saying a lot of...
Because the physical manifestation of it is keeping us from the real thing. Just like they have a lot of chemical...
So that's not the real thing.
No, it's not. It's a reflection of the real thing.
Why does it exist?
Why does it exist?
You're saying that illusions don't have any value in life.
No, they don't. They have value if you use them in the service of the truth, then they end up having value, then they change, because the illusion is also created by truth.
But women and men are not going to get together unless they have that illusion.
No, they can get together in the service of truth rather than to perpetuate illusion. That's also possible. One can have a relationship with a man and a woman where they help each other in enlightenment, and they use their sexuality to produce children who they're going to train in enlightenment, and as expression of their love between each other to gain enlightenment, then their sexuality is not entangling.
That sounds like an ideal.
It is, and it's not easy to achieve.
But you think it's possible?
I know it's possible.
Okay.
It's difficult. And it's difficult to achieve consistently. So even in a relationship between a man and a woman where they achieve that sometimes, it's very difficult to achieve it consistently.
And what happens when they stop loving each other? If things don't stay the same, things change. Then what do people do?
Ideally? Or what do people actually do?
Ideally. We know what they do.
Okay. What ideally happens is that at least until the children are grown, that there's some responsibility, and when the children are grown, then you can become renounced to family life.
You're assuming that you keep saying they have children. What happens if they don't have children?
Children or no children, at a certain age, it's natural to become renounced from family life. What happens in modern society is people just look for a new partner. But the general tendency is that once you get older, you lose your interest in this sort of thing. And one should go more for a life of contemplation and meditation. That's the ideal.
But then you have a solitary path.
You have what?
You can very likely have a solitary path. As you just said, when you get older, you get closer to enlightenment, you lose interest in these things. So in fact...
Well, you have a society, but you're not going to have any more... Even if you keep a relationship with your spouse, that relationship ceases to be sexual at all. It becomes fully spiritual. But for some, yes, it's going to be a solitary path to some extent. I mean, we have a society of practitioners of bhakti yoga. There's no reason for anybody to be totally solitary. Nor do we even recommend that. But for many people, there comes a time in life as they get older when they really no longer want to be with their partner and they want to engage in meditation and contemplation. That's natural.
And then you can separate.
Yes. You can either stay together and you can... lead a life of more meditation and contemplation and pilgrimage as a couple, but without the passion. Or you can separate and lead a life that way as separate entities to whatever degree you have to maintain your friendship. Yes?
Earlier on, you said that the purpose of living was happiness.
Yes.
What is your definition of happiness?
Something that keeps getting better and better and better. That doesn't stop for a moment. That's full of variety. That's full of relationship. That permeates all of your senses and your mind with light and with joy. That has a wide range and variety of emotion. And excitement and surprise, along with constancy. I'm sure I could do better than that, but that's what I can do on the fly for a definition. That happiness is our natural right. It's our natural state of existence, which is why we're looking for it. I saw a billboard the other day for some ice cream that said something like more intense pleasure longer. And I thought, yeah, that's what everybody's looking for. Something that lasts longer. And something that keeps getting better and that's intense. So why are we looking for that? There's nothing material that's going to give you that. So where does that desire come from unless we actually have experienced it sometime? Yes, ma'am?
Have you found happiness yourself?
Not completely, but yes. I found it enough to know that it's real. Yes.
Is it important what we were in past lives? No. At all?
Yes, slightly. Yes. Not terribly important. What we were in past lives has a big effect on who we are now and how we think now. But wherever we are, we can always start from where we are. The nice thing about bhakti is it doesn't depend on what I've done even in this life, or to speak of what I've done in past lives. It's available to anybody now. Okay, so when I was told when the prasadam comes down, I'm supposed to stop.
One more question.
Parashuram, does this mean I'm supposed to stop now that I see you serving out plates? Is that how it works?
A couple of minutes.
One more question.
Okay, yes.
When we hear of the roles women played in Vedic society, we find that most of the time they, you know, their duties are confined to the home.
Really?
Really? Like, in the sense of, like,
can you give me an example from scripture where you find that piece?
Maybe Devahuti, where she was constantly engaged in serving Kadama Muni.
She also traveled in a spaceship all over the universe. You have Draupadi, who was the secretary of the treasury. She told Satyabhama, she said, I'm the only one, you know, her husband was the emperor. She said, I'm the only one who knows the income and the outgo, the income and the expenditures of the government. And she was managing the royal city of 100,000 people. So she was managing 100,000 people, and she was the secretary of the treasury. Yes.
Is it considered rare for someone to be happy in the material world?
Yes. Out of many thousands among people, one will even ask, what is going on in this place?
It's a madhouse.
Only one out of thousands will even ask the question, what's wrong here? What's going on? Why, when I do everything that's supposed to make me satisfied, am I not satisfied? Only one in a thousand will even ask that question. Then out of all those who ask that question, out of thousands of people who ask that question, maybe one will actually strive to become enlightened and become actually happy. But it's the birthright of every living being. It's the natural state of every living being. And that real happiness is not dependent on your material situation. That real happiness can be there whether you're rich or poor or old or young or ugly or beautiful or healthy or sick or whatever. It's something that's within. Materialistic beings are thinking that their happiness is external. Never going to become happy by external things. Not real happiness, not the happiness we seek. You're going to become temporarily, mentally satisfied, you know. Oh, look at this house. You know, and you'll feel that way for a week. And then you'll say, oh, this thing I don't like, and this thing. Or something else will come. Yes?
What do you think this term used for people today in this world are calling the workforce of human results?
I've never had anybody ask a question like that before. A human resource. I think it's symptomatic of our general tendency to see all objects, natural resources, the whole cosmos, and every other living being as something for me to use to gratify my own desires, which is the antithesis of spiritual vision. But that was a really good question. I've never even thought about it before. Nor have I ever had anyone else ask me that. Well, that's okay. Anybody else? Okay, we have, yes?
I think especially like,
living outside and you're constantly bombarded with isolation.
Living outside.
As in,
by the way, with that probably sounds to other people here like you live in a tent. I don't think that's what you intended to say. Or that you live on the sidewalk, you know. Living outside. Yes.
I get living and working outside.
Outside of what, dear? Outside of a temple ashram is what you mean, right? Okay. Yes.
And you're constantly bombarded with these illusions. How do you best practice so you come closer to the truth? Because it seems really difficult when you're outside and kind of...
We have a whole seminar just on this topic. Like an hour seminar just on this topic, so I don't know if I can do justice to it now. But a lot of it has to do with how you prioritize your time, who you associate with, and also the illusion is seeing things as separate from Krishna. That's what makes it an illusion. If you can see how everything is connected with Krishna, then you're seeing truth. You're not seeing illusion. When you say, I'm bombarded with illusion, what we mean by that is that there's so many things around you that are saying, you can be happy separate from the truth. So see everything is related to Krishna. He's the light of the sun. He's the heat and fires, your digestive abilities, your breath of life. He's your abilities, your intelligence. He's the life of all that lives. He's the strength of the strong. You're dripping all over the place. So you might want to, I would suggest that you look in Bhagavad Gita chapter 7, chapter 9, chapter 10, and chapter 15. 7, 9, 10, and 15. And look at the verses there and choose verses that will really help you to see how everything's ultimately connected with truth. As soon as you see that, then your experience of living in the world will be very different. Okay, and I have other suggestions, but I think that's really more for a whole seminar. So thank you very much. I hope I've said at least one thing that each of you finds useful, and if I've said anything that you think is foolish, please ignore it. If I've said anything useful, I hope you can take it on board and help to improve your life. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Thank you. Hare Krishna.